Welcome to the Frontline Industry Podcast. Every week, we talk with top senior executives to get their advice on positively impacting frontline employees, companies, and customers. On today's episode, Fixing Healthcare, I talk with Chris Malone, award-winning author, speaker, thought leader, strategic advisor, and C-level growth executive with multiple Fortune 500 companies. Chris discusses how to solve the time pressures faced by short-staffed healthcare providers, the cost of focusing too much on efficiency, an incredible story of Starbucks workers that will warm your heart, how the key to happiness is serving others, and much more. Don't go anywhere. The Frontline Industry Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the Frontline Industry Podcast. My name is Joel, and joining me today is Chris Malone. He's an award-winning author, a speaker, a thought leader, strategic advisor, and C-level growth executive with multiple Fortune 500 companies. He's a senior marketing and customer experience leader as well, with over 30 years of experience in the consumer packaged goods, hospitality, food service, and consulting industries, with a proven track record for leading teams of up to 800 and overseeing billion-dollar P&Ls for global enterprises. Today, Chris is the founder and leader of Fidelum Health, an insights, analytics, and strategy consulting firm that enables simpler understanding and delivery of breakthrough patient experiences and staff engagement in the post-COVID healthcare environment. Chris, wow, what a background. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Great to be with you, Joel.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I'd love to start us off by just touching on something as part of your intro there. What is a breakthrough patient experience? Talk to me about what that means to you.
Sure. You know, a breakthrough patient experience, in my view, is one where both the care provider and the patient feel an emotional connection. And it turns out from all that we've learned, that's important to be a two-way street. From the patient's perspective, they need to feel like you care about them as a person more than just a number or a diagnosis, and that you're taking the time to listen to them and, you know, seek their input and understand what matters to them. Mm. But just as importantly, it's important for the care provider to feel like they're making a difference in that patient's life, because it turns out not only does that kind of mutual two-way connection make the patient more confident and trusting and more likely to stay engaged in care and to have better medical outcomes, but that is the emotional fuel for care providers that brought them to a career in healthcare that sustains them. And we're now, unfortunately, in kind of an epidemic, if you will, of burnout and strain and understaffing in healthcare. And the solution to that is really the same for both the patient and the caregiver: more time and opportunity to make that emotional connection where they are feeling, you know, a mutual benefit out of the experience.
Well, the word that stands out to me in your explanation, which I really appreciate, is right at the end: time. Healthcare, they're running around like chickens with their heads cut off, not because they're innately stressed people, but because the environment that they're in is just so hectic. And I think I've seen, you know, my father right now is stage four cancer. I've been spending a lot of time, you know, in the doctor's office with him in different healthcare environments, and they have so much going on. And it seems like so little of it is actually patient care. And that time that is being sucked away to doing more non-value-added admin, maybe it's valuable to a certain extent. Obviously, it has to be there. But when it comes to patient care, it's not valuable, right? As far as the way that patient experiences care. Talk to me about how that world continues to evolve, and where did we come from and where are we now when it comes to that distraction?
Well, you're exactly right, Joel, and you put your finger right on the issue. And that is that even before the pandemic, the time pressure and strain on doctors and nurses and frontline care providers was very significant. And it's for a number of reasons. One is that as care has become more and more specialized, there are more and more handoffs from a patient onto multiple different care providers. As healthcare kind of struggles to make progress in digitizing the experience, there's been lots of inefficiency, lots of administrative burdens added. The adoption of electronic medical records has been a tremendous burden on nurses and doctors to document, you know, each of those interactions. It takes a lot of their time to do that. And then there's lots of regulation as well. And so now if you add to that, what has happened over the last 3 years is roughly 20% of all nursing positions are now vacant. And so they're now struggling to do 100% of the same work with only 80% of the people working overtime and working short staffed. And it's just running folks into the ground. And just as you said, they are racing through a checklist of tasks that they can never keep up with. And it doesn't really allow the time that both the patient and the care provider need to connect with that other person and feel like they're both getting out of that interaction what they need emotionally. There's a lot of clinical medical care being delivered, and that's certainly important, but that alone is not enough for those two to kind of feel fulfilled out of that experience.
Yeah, sitting with my dad in some of these recent appointments, fortunately, he's had some really good care. His lead care providers have been really personal, and it's been really impactful. But you can just tell how much is on their mind. And, you know, I, as a family member whose, you know, father is sitting there terminal, the thing that you don't want to feel is like your dad is one of many today, and it's on to the next one, and you're just kind of a conversation to have, and I'm off to the next room. You want to feel like it's as weighty to them as it is to you. Like, this really matters to you. This really is weighing on you, because this is the first and last time I will have this experience, right? Even though it's one of 25 or whatever experiences for that doctor today or care provider today. And I wonder, what's the solution then? I mean, is it a reimagining of roles and limit and bringing on admin roles to offload those nurses? Is it an overhaul of the healthcare system as a whole in some general ways? Like, what do we do, Chris?
Yeah, there's a number of opportunities and issues. One is that there are many, many opportunities to redesign and make more efficient processes. Healthcare is not known for efficient process design. If anyone, you've ever been to the doctor's office and filled out paperwork by hand, the same paperwork every time you visit, you know that someone has to handle that paperwork and enter it. You know and have seen this firsthand. There's a lot of opportunity for process redesign to improve that. And by doing so, particularly for all of those administrative non-clinical tasks, that the more we can kind of take those off the plate of the nurses and the doctors and free them up to connect more emotionally and more personally with patients, they'll both benefit from that. But that's one part of it. And of course, the other thing that's going on is with trying to control the increase in cost of healthcare. They're trying to kind of scale things and make things more efficient and standardize processes and so forth. But the loss that comes from standardization and making really those experiences more transactional is greater than the benefit. Right. And one of the things that we've learned from all of our work over the last decade is that even in industries where you would think by nature it's going to be transactional, right? I'm going through the drive-thru at Starbucks, or I'm going to pick up the dry cleaning or what have you. It turns out that we as a species are so strongly wired by evolution to want to engage in relationships with one another that even in these transactional environments, we are driven by the degree to which the other person kind of demonstrate that they're kind of interested in us for more than what's in our wallet, right? And nothing could be more personal than healthcare, particularly like literally life and death situations that, you know, nothing matters more. And so, you know, feeling like you are a person that is cared about, and they're asking you basically to put your life in their hands and to trust their decisions and their actions and so forth, that kind of making that connection more personally is really, really critical. And even in a situation where the outcome, you know, is known to be death in the end, that the way that we handle those conversations and those interactions to show compassion and care and empathy makes a big difference. You can't change the outcome, but you can change that interaction. And that makes all the difference in the world.
I think there's a lot of industries that, you know, pretty much anybody could go into if they've got the right brain wiring. You know, engineers can go into a variety of engineering fields, or mathematicians can go into a bunch of different fields that are very, you know, they're less specialized. But you think about healthcare and the sort of people that gravitate to healthcare. Yeah, there's going to be some people in there who are just in it for the money or just in it for whatever. But in general, they're people who just genuinely deeply care about people. And it must be very frustrating, obviously, to have that time removed where they can slow down to really deliver the sort of intentional care. I wonder about how, you know, we can create the environment for authentic interaction that slows down like that. And how that idea permeates other industries, as you talk about the Starbucks drive-through. You know, when I think about authentic connection in those sort of environments, having worked, you know, 6 years in a retail environment early in my career in the sales environment at Sprint or selling cars or team or AT&T or whatever it may be, you know, my team that I was leading or myself in customer interactions, I always would be looking for little things to make a personal connection on, right? When you and I first talked, I identified the surfboard behind you and asked you about what that is, that special to you and what's going on with that. And these are not things that are trivial or contrived. They're genuine interest, right? I genuinely want to know. And sometimes we find ourselves in a position at the Starbucks drive-thru where it's efficiency, and we've got a timer above us and it's counting down how long it takes to serve each customer, and we're graded on that. And there's probably, I would imagine, some sort of bonus structure or award system in place when you hit those things, or negative things that happen if you don't. How do we balance this desperate need for efficiency and productivity and getting people through the door and out again while not losing that human touch?
Yeah, it's all about balancing and priority. And so, for instance, I believe that one of the things that unfortunately has become a kind of a widespread belief is that there is no cost to economies of scale. And so as we scale things and seek to make them more efficient and perhaps more automated and so forth, if we thought that the cost that we save there or the efficiency that we gain did not have a cost, we were wrong about that. And to the degree that becomes much more transactional, the cost is the loyalty and the relationship that may, you know, develop between the customer and the provider in that instance. And so we've got to balance, you know, our need for efficiency and scale with what are the metrics and the outcomes that we are really trying to drive. It can't be just, you know, time to serve or revenue or profit or what have you, because if that happens at the expense of the relationship with the customer, it's actually going to cost us far more in loyalty and future repeat sales than it will in the efficiency saving. And so we've got to kind of keep the best interest of not only the customer in mind, but also the frontline, you know, provider, in the sense that if we're doing it at their expense and that we're not giving them emotionally what they need, you know, in order to kind of feel fulfilled and look forward to this work and get out of bed every day and be energized to try to take care of customers, you know, we can't get away with doing things at their expense for very long anymore. Word travels further and faster than ever before, and we're going to be held accountable, whether it's that you can't fill those roles or people are kind of quiet quitting and doing the minimum at work or what have you. There's going to be a cost to that. And so it's not to suggest that profitability and cost containment isn't important, but we've got to keep it in balance with the needs of these other stakeholders in order for it to be sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, I think about the little things and getting back to the little things that matter. Just, you know, the eye contact, the smile, the quick hello, right? As opposed to back to Starbucks again, I'm picking on them, but, you know, the rather than just putting my drink out there and randomly calling Joel, not even looking my direction or wondering who I am, but just looking for me and handing my drink to me and making that handoff, right? Those little things just go a very long way. So I'd love to hear about your book, The Human Brand, and how you have kind of taken the insights and studies from that book and how that impacts that world. What things have you studied that have led you to ultimately doing what you're doing at Fidelum, but really at a broader perspective, what insights have you seen around the way the human wants to interact with the other human?
Absolutely. And I'd like to start with actually a story that builds off of your previous comment about those little things. And it's a story that's in my book, and it's one from my personal experience, and I think it kind of is a nice setup for the explanation I'll provide. And, you know, one of the ways that I explain this is I first learned back in 2006 that the tremendous success that Starbucks has had is not because of the quality of their coffee, the speed of their service, the price, or the location, or the loyalty program, but rather it's how they recruit, manage, and motivate hourly employee. And at that time, I was senior vice president of marketing for Aramark Corporation, a big food service company that provides food service in hospitals and universities and stadiums and things like that. And at the time, Aramark was a licensee of Starbucks and operated about 75 Starbucks locations on college campuses. As you know, college students need and love their coffee. And the problem was at the time that actually Aramark was about to lose their license because we were not providing the customer experience that Starbucks demanded and was able to deliver in their own location.
Wow.
And so this would have been a huge problem in a last-ditch effort to try to preserve the relationship. Starbucks invited a handful of senior executives to go to Seattle and spend a few days getting immersed in how they delivered all of their experience. And we expected to hear about how they selected their coffee beans and how they roasted them and designed their locations and the flow of traffic. And we certainly heard all of that. But the thing that was the missing ingredient, the thing that was the eye-opener for us, was again how they recruited and managed those hourly employees. And they told us about something called the Little Green Apron Book, which was, as the name suggests, a little green book that would fit in the pocket of the apron of each, what they call associate. And in that book, they talked about five ways of being, things like being knowledgeable, considerate, involved, and things of that nature. And these were kind of intended to not only be things that they demonstrated to customers, but also to their colleagues and to one another. And inside the book, there were five little business card-sized cards. On the front was a description of each way of being, and on the back were just blank lines. And they were expected to kind of catch each other in the act of doing these things right, whether it was remembering a customer's order or remembering a customer by name or offering to pick up a shift for a colleague or what have you. And they would kind of write down what they had done, and they would present these to one another every day. And what really surprised us is this wasn't just one of those nice ideas that sat on a shelf or in a drawer or what have you, but they actually in the back room would have an apron with a little cardboard cuff, and they would collect these, you know, and five or six of these would be awarded each day. And at the end of each month, they would gather up the cards and send them to the district office, and they would be written up into stories that were shared across the organization, celebrating and recognizing and encouraging all the different ways they had found to practice these five ways of being. And so they shared one of these stories with us that really brought it home, and I think really illustrates the point that you made earlier. They told us a story about one of their stores on the West Coast who had a regular customer named Pete. And Pete was an elderly gentleman who would come in a few times a week, read the paper in the corner, and then leave. Everyone got to know Pete by name. He had come in for several years in a row. And then a few weeks went by where Pete didn't come in. And they started to ask each other, hey, has anyone seen Pete? Someone said, I think he has a daughter in L.A. Maybe he's visiting her. Another week or so went by, still no Pete. And then one afternoon, a young woman came in and said, does anyone here know a customer named Pete? And they said, sure, we know Pete. Where has he been? Has he been on vacation? And she said, no, actually, Pete is my dad, and I'm sorry to say that he had a heart attack and passed away. And so I'm in town going through his apartment and putting all his affairs in order. And while I was doing that, I found something that really surprised me. In a closet, I found these two big bags, and inside these bags were Starbucks cups. And written on them were things like, have a nice day, come back soon, hope you feel better. Apparently, these meant so much to my dad, he couldn't bear to throw them away. And I just wanted to come down and thank you for the difference you've been making in his life. I never knew about that. And so it begs the same question, right? What caused Pete to keep the cups? It wasn't the coffee, the speed of the service, the location. It was these little gestures that cost us nothing, but make the greatest difference because they demonstrate that we care about another person. And so that's, you know, kind of building on your point, and this really hit home for us. What we had is all the competence, all the skill to make the beverages. What we weren't doing was providing the opportunity and the encouragement for staff to interact with customers this way. And the reason why this matters to us, it turns out, and this is what we write about in our book, is that we were hardwired by evolution to make two kinds of judgments whenever we interact with another person for survival purposes. First, we're using all our senses to try to determine what are the intentions of this person toward me. Are they a friend or a foe, going to help us or hurt us, give us something or take something from us? Or said another way, what degree of warmth do they have towards me? And then given what we think their intentions may be, what ability do they have to carry out those intentions? Are they strong or weak, fast or slow, foolish or intelligent? Or what degree of competence they have? And it turns out that these were critical decisions because they guided us not only through our interactions with strangers, but also to form relationships in our tribe and in our community, which were critical to survival. And so now roughly 80% of our behavior, according to social psychologists, is driven by this. And it really, you know, it drives a lot of our behavior. And so the reason that we respond so strongly to that story and that Pete responded so strongly to the little acts of goodwill is, despite that all we've been taught and trained in life, that our success becomes from our competence, actually warmth is the dominant drive of our behavior because it was more predictive of our survival and evolution. So that's why these gestures of warmth lead to relationships that lead to loyalty and lead to, you know, outcomes, and why it's so critical. And it's what we talk about in our book, that we have, you know, now more than ever, the need to rediscover that and make sure that we are addressing it in all that we do. So I'll pause there. Sorry for the long
explanation. No, what a wonderful summary. And that just resonates so much in my experience in, you know, 17 years of sales and, you know, every industry, you know, from the front lines of, again, the Sprint store to selling body shop software to working in manufacturing to working in hospitality. It's just like, no matter what you do, yeah, people want to know that you can deliver your promise as a brand, as an organization, service, technology, but to know that behind the scenes that, you know, that's the secret sauce is like, I'm looking at you to go, yeah, I'm assuming you can deliver the things you can say you do because you're a company and that makes you somewhat legitimate. But are you going to be there for me? Are you going to care for me when it gets tough and things go wrong? Because things inevitably go wrong in many, many experiences in our life. So that's awesome. I mean, so Chris, when you at Fidelum now are looking at insights, looking at analytics and developing strategy for your clients, is this the stuff you're looking at?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So kind of we've got three imperatives that probably apply to us all individually as well as organizationally. If we really want to kind of build lasting relationships and loyalty and consistent growth and so forth. Then the first is we got to become more self-aware of how we're coming across to others on the basis of warmth and competence. And kind of despite the remarkable gift we've all been given by evolution to have the ability to perceive the intentions and abilities of others, it turns out we are all equally cursed with blinders, often unable to see how our own words and actions are coming across to others. And as a result, we often inadvertently rub them the wrong way, often without even knowing it, and send a message, I'm only interested in myself. And it causes them to be very cautious and not very trusting of us. This happens when, you know, we're trying to kind of grow as fast as we can or sell as much as we can or get as much as we can as our primary motive. That comes across, right? And people are like, I can see, you know, that what you're after and I may need to look out for myself. And to your point, while the products need to be of quality and reliability, all of those kind of competence related things, those are what we call kind of price of entry expectations. I wouldn't consider you at all if you didn't have that. But in most cases, there are lots of choices where it meet that price of entry expectation.
Right.
And if one offered a lower price or a new incentive, I would probably switch back and forth between them pretty easily. Where loyalty and trust and commitment come from is all of that human emotional stuff. Because now I feel like not only do you have a product that meets my requirements, but you're actually looking out for what's in my interest, not just what's in your own interest. And so that's how we kind of approach it. One is you got to become more self-aware of how you're coming across. Second, you got to be willing to make significant change based on what you learned from that. Things that were acceptable 20 years ago, you can't get by with anymore. You got to be willing to change. And then what we talked about before, you've got to be willing to kind of rebalance your priorities and making sure that you're putting those relationships and the best interests of all your stakeholders in equal priority, where you're not going to be able to kind of keep things going sustainably.
In the healthcare world, who struggles to adopt this message the most?
I would say that an awful lot of what is taught and trained in healthcare is all on the medical clinical side. And, you know, medicine has become remarkable in the way it's been able to cure diseases and extend our life and the adoption of technology and biological research and pharmaceuticals and you name it, right? Mm-hmm. Where they're not as strong is on the social science side of things, all of the human interaction. And there are many, you know, through no fault of their own, there are many physicians and surgeons and things like that who were trained, you know, through all of their education, that all that mattered was the medical stuff. And if you get the medical stuff right, that's the definition of being a good doctor. But it turns out that that's actually not true, because you can do all of the right medical stuff, but if the patient doesn't trust you and doesn't come back for the follow-up appointment, or the patient doesn't trust them and doesn't take the medication, or the patient doesn't trust them and make changes to their lifestyle, the outcome is still going to be a negative health outcome. And so what we are trying to share with them is that, yes, all the medical stuff matters. That's a given. But you got to kind of build the interpersonal part into it as well, and make those patients feel cared for emotionally and about as an individual if you want to get the right medical outcome. And so that's where I would say those who have a really strong clinical medical orientation, this is new for them, right? And it's not unlike what we've seen in other parts of business. You know, finance executives and legal executives who have been trained to get as much as we can, or to make sure that, you know, the odds are stacked in our favor. That's how they were trained, right? And it turns out that a lot of that stuff is just fundamentally at odds with what it takes for people to trust one another. And so that's how we're kind of having to, you know, re-inspire and educate them in healthcare in the same way we have in business.
You know, I, as a parent, think a lot about the need for re-education, or what do we teach at home, or what are we trying to re-educate based on what they're hearing somewhere else, and how do we maintain a sense of home where there's a central place of truth, there's a central place of building your values and such. And, you know, re-education can be very important and necessary and critical, but how do we push this back to like origin type sort of things? Like, how can we, instead of re-educate, educate? How can this stuff be embedded into college and higher education and medical training and stuff like that? What kind of thoughts, or what sort of stuff have you done in that area?
Yeah, so a couple of things come to mind. One is that I believe most of us are born with everything we need to know about how to form relationships and trust with another person. And I think, unfortunately, systematically, we are kind of taught and trained out of a lot of that stuff over the course of life. You know, and I think, you know, not with negative intentions. I think in many cases people have the best of intentions, but don't realize that this is how we are wired. I mean, this warmth and competence stuff is all a subconscious perception process. If we were all consciously aware that we were making decisions this way, we wouldn't be having this conversation. It would be totally unnecessary, right?
Yeah.
And so there's this kind of subconscious part that we need to become more knowledgeable about how we are wired by evolution with one another in that regard. And I think there is a simple rule of thumb that we often refer to, if you kind of really want to boil it all down. It's what we call kind of the principle of worthy intention. And that's the idea that I'm going to put the best interest of the other person ahead of my own in the short term to demonstrate to them that my intentions are worthy of their trust and loyalty. And that because of the way they were wired, you know, by evolution, there is this human nature of reciprocity, right? When someone shows trust or goodwill or a gesture towards me, that is a signal of what their intentions are, and it is in my nature to reciprocate. And so, you know, putting the best interest of others first in the short term doesn't require us to recklessly disregard our own best interest, but rather it's a form of enlightened self-interest, because when we do that in the short term, we get far more back in the medium and long term. And that can really guide us in virtually every interaction that we have with others, I think.
I mean, you've basically described the adage, it's better to give than to receive. I mean, that's it.
And not only, you know, the ironic thing, there's many, you know, studies and books coming out, you know, two in particular that I would mention that are by the same authors. One is called Compassionomics, which is all a study by two research physicians from Cooper University Health System that show that there's hundreds of clinical medical studies that show compassion are actually the missing ingredient to a lot of healthcare outcomes. But they've also just come out with another book called Wonder Drug, where basically this notion is, provided tons of evidence that basically the key to happiness is serving others. essentially. And that when we serve others, it has not only positive psychological benefits for us, but lots of physiological and biological benefits and so forth. And so this stuff is all connected and wired into us to a much greater degree than I ever realized. I always thought that kind of psychologically and emotionally this would be good for us. I never imagined that it was also kind of biologically and physiologically good for us as well.
Wow. I mean, there's so many implications for that reality of healthcare, even of like, what should, you know, think of my own father, like, what should you be busying yourself doing right now? You know, it's almost counterintuitive that in the midst of a significant illness that you should now go serve other people. That's but maybe right. That is a healing balm that you would actually receive and may make a significant difference in your mood and your health and provide longevity. You know, these are critical things for us to embrace and understand, Chris.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, even beyond what it takes for frontline workers in all industries to feel fulfilled, stay in their jobs, be productive, be happy, to advance, to grow and develop and all of that, there's just this such more foundational human, you know, existence implications of it as well.
Absolutely. Well, Chris, I don't want to keep you too long today, but man, what a great conversation. And I wonder, you know, there are a lot of people listening who are executive leaders in mm-hmm. a variety of fields. I have two final questions. And the first one is, what's your piece of advice for them to bring the human back to work?
Yeah, I mean, I would say intellectual curiosity. I kind of feel like, given what I've learned over the past decade or so, that perhaps 50% of what I was taught and trained in universities and graduate school and large companies and so forth, that perhaps 50% of that is either no longer true or may not have ever been true. Hmm. And so we've got to kind of continue to challenge, you know, conventional wisdom and say, is this really true anymore? And is it having the outcomes that we want? Or is there a better way to do things? You know, and we are all, our lives have been transformed by technology. And one of the things, the consequences of that is that the degree to which we are all doing things in a more digital, remote way, that actually is disrupting what we were wired by evolution to do more face-to-face, right? Commerce between humans for most of human history has been conducted face-to-face. That's where we picked up all of that warmth and competence information using yeah. facial expressions and body language and tone of voice and words and action and appearance and all of that. Whereas it's now the app and the click and the touch and so forth. And if we're not having those face-to-face interactions, we're going to have to find other ways to demonstrate that we're putting the best interest of other people first in our policies, practices, processes, and so forth. So I'd say continue to look at, you know, what the impact of all of this remote work and digital interaction and so forth is on the relationships we're building with our frontline staff, as well as with our stakeholders and customers and patients.
Mm. That's really good. I've said this before in the podcast, but it's a good reminder. I mean, when I've trained in sales reps or customer service people or whoever in both frontline and corporate, you know, roles, many times I'd ask, is there a podcast? Is there a book? Is there a thing you subscribe to that I should memorize and understand and learn? And it came down to two C's for me. It was, are you curious and do you care?
That's right. And that's a great way to put it. I love that.
And it's like, if you're curious and you actually care, yes, there's going to be things you need to ask in certain orders in order to get certain information or outcomes, or things you need to do in certain orders to get certain outcomes. But you don't need to be stressed as much about the exactness of that. I mean, I think about our podcast today, Chris. I had a couple things in mind to talk to you about, but none of this is contrived, right? None of it was written down and scripted. It's like, I'm just curious and I actually care, you know, and that's not a pat on my back. It's just how I think all of us should be. You know, that would, I think, in many ways solve a lot of the problems in the service industry, in the frontline industries, that if we provide people the space to be curious and care and not engineer that out of their jobs by being overly prescriptive or overly didactic when it comes down to efficiencies and productivities. But also if we, of course, as you mentioned, hire the right people and then release them, just let them go and let them, as you mentioned at the Starbucks, you know, little booklet and things like that, just be themselves. They will be the best versions of themselves many times.
That's exactly right. There's not a 27-step checklist You know, there's steps into how to make the beverages, right? But how to connect with the customer, five general principles, and we empower to use your good human, you know, intelligence and personality to perceive what is needed by that customer in that time and to connect with them in a personalized way.
And you can't really train that. I mean, that's innate. Like a lot of people, even most people, I would say, given the right environments, will be those sort of people. But a lot of times our environments we've created just don't allow them to. So that's awesome,
that's
Chris.
Right.
So last question for you, Chris, and that is, what is something that you believe that everyone else believed too would make this world a better place?
I think that it's about relationship. I think all of the work that we have done has suggested, and you know, there are many others that have found their way to a similar conclusion, but that at the end of the day, whether it's your success professionally, your success in your family and personal relationships, you know, your success, you know, in building an organization, that it all comes down to relationships, and that in order to build a relationship, you got to demonstrate warmth and competence and to put the best interests of other people ahead of your own. But that is kind of the universal metric. It's not dollars. It's not cents. It's not followers. It's not likes. It's not those kinds of things. And what, you know, caregivers who provide end-of-life care, what they say over and over again is that the things that people cherish most at the end of life or regret most was all about their relationship with other people. And that's where it not only sustains your life, but it becomes the most meaningful thing for you. And so I would say, think of yourself as Johnny Appleseed, and that you are dropping seeds everywhere you go and trying to, you know, initiate relationships. Some of those seeds will take root, some of them will not. But that at the end of the day, it's all about building a sustaining relationship.
Well, I know a lot of people here, and myself too often in my life as well, are people who can get caught up chasing the dollar, chasing the title, chasing their, you know, external accolades, while frankly ignoring those very relationships that matter the most, perhaps even burning the relationships that matter most. And they get back to the end of their life and they go, crap, what have I done? You know, and I encourage anyone listening to take some time this week to refocus and ask, am I prioritizing relationships really authentically? You know, where am I spending my time? Where am I spending my money? What am I spending my thoughts? And if they're not on relationships in some way, shape, or form, in strong, healthy, dynamic relationships, you might have your focus in the wrong spot. What a great reminder, Chris. Thank you so much for spending time with me today.
Great to talk with you, Joel.
Well, thank you for everyone listening as well. This has been another awesome episode of the Frontline Industry Podcast, and we hope to see you next time. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Impact Tomorrow Today. Transform your ability to lead and drive results. What was your takeaway? Mine was that the key to happiness is serving others, and I'm going to challenge myself to do one act of service each day. What did you take away, and how are you going to live differently? As you develop as a leader and care for others, I'd be honored to take that journey with you if you'd tune in and subscribe to our future podcasts and share this episode with others. See you next time.